Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the last 30 years, the athletic industrial complex has transformed itself into a trillion-dollar global entity. According to today's guest, sports writer Dave Zirin, one way this industry makes so much money is by making its products and its players as explicitly apolitical as possible. In his new book, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, Dave Zirin writes, quote, from Peyton Manning to Derek Jeter to Danica Patrick, the dominant message projected by athletes has been that it's far more important to be a brand than an individual, and that a modern jock should never sacrifice commercial concerns for political principle. This credo echoes Jesse Owens, the great Olympic star, who once said, the only time the black fist has significance is when there's money inside, end quote. But Dave Zirin argues that all of this is changing. He writes about athletes who are speaking out across the political spectrum, and whether you see yourself as a sports fan or not, Dave Zirin believes that we all have a stake in understanding why the sports page is insufficient for understanding sports. Dave Zirin is a columnist for The Nation, Slam Magazine, and SportsIllustrated.com. SI.com. He's the host of SiriusXM's weekly show Edge of Sports Radio and is a regular guest on ESPN's Outside the Lines. His previous books include A People's History of Sports in the United States. And Dave joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back here. Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, you have a sportscaster's voice.
Well, it kind of goes with the territory. They hand you those after you get your first press pass.
So, you know, it's interesting because you spend a lot of time writing about the intersection between sports and politics. And you've got so many interesting stories in your book about athletes speaking out. I love the story, again, about the Green Bay Packers being a community-run nonprofit. But first off, let's really talk about how what you call the athletic industrial complex has transformed itself into a trillion-dollar global entity over the last couple of decades. How have they really done this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the number one way they've done this is by relying upon and making the arguments for public subsidies. Whether you're talking about the Olympics or the World Cup, or whether you're talking about your local team, although the San Francisco Giants, I do have to say, are a notable and singular exception to this in many respects. The idea that you need to be buttressed by corporate welfare if you're going to have a sports franchise has been a transformative argument over the last 20, 30 years. The other aspect that's transformed sports mightily has been the advent of cable television. We've all seen our cable bills go up over the last 30 years. And oftentimes what causes them to go up is new contracts with sports franchises. And of course that varies from city to city, which also causes in most sports an incredible competitive imbalance between the teams that are able to get these mega buck cable contracts and teams that are not. But however you want to slice it, the main point I'm trying to make is that for most sports and most sports franchises, whether you see yourself as a sports fan or not, sports is hitting you in your pocketbook.
Right. Well, and this is what I'd love you to elaborate on, because we often hear about, you know, how much it costs to build the new Yankees stadium and why the 49ers are leaving, or, you know, why different sports teams go from city to city. So how can those of us who might maybe don't follow this as closely, how can we really understand the economics behind all of this and how it's really hitting our communities in their pocketbooks?
Well, I would venture that anybody who would listen to your show has a very clear sense about what's going on in sports, even if they've never picked up the sports page in their life. If they have a semblance of knowledge about what occurred in the financial sector, for example, in the 2000s, or what occurred in the housing market in the 2000s, or what occurs when you get these inflated bubble economies around different issues that are either stood up by public welfare or eventually bailed out by public welfare when the bubble eventually goes burst. And this is not just a coincidence. This is not just sports reflecting Wall Street or sports reflecting the real estate market. Oftentimes, it's the very same people, the same owners of sports teams are the same people who are the titans of industry or the titans of global energy or or the titans of real estate, who then see sports as just another in a multiplicity of holdings. So it's the same mentality that these new age owners have brought into sports. This idea that says we need the public to put skin in the game if they want to have sports, and actually selling us on this idea, which I would argue is a very false idea, that the framework of the debate has to be either you spend your tax dollars on this or you're not going to have it at all.
And talk a little bit about how this works, because in your book you write about then Florida, now Miami Marlins, owned by multimillionaire art dealer Jeffrey Loria. The Marlins built a stadium that will cost the public $2 billion over the next 40 years, all while lying about their bottom line to max out their corporate welfare potential. So mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that, and how did that actually work out behind the scenes?
No, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a strong differentiation between sports and other industries, is this idea of what's called the antitrust exemption. And what that allows is it allows for the business of sports to be able to keep their books closed from public view while at the same time asking for public money. Now, this should be an incredible scandal in every city, and there should be the demand for full transparency if you're getting even one solitary red cent of public money. Yet in the case of the Marlins, it led to a situation where team executives appeared in front of the Miami City Council and said, we're losing money hand over fist. We can't afford to keep the team open unless you give us over $1 billion for this new stadium. And the city council's response was, well, Forbes magazine says that you guys actually made tens of millions of dollars last year. And their response was, well, Forbes is wrong. They haven't seen our books. And then the city council says, well, will you show us your books? They say, no. And it becomes almost like the Jedi mind trick scene in Star Wars, where it's like you have no use for seeing these books, and the city council says we have no use for seeing these books. Now, in some cases, you could argue that this is outright corruption and the corrupting of public officials, like by giving untold amounts of money to buy public officials. In some cases, it's fear by public officials of not wanting to be remembered as the person who lost the team. But however it works, it is the taxpayer, it is the citizen who ends up getting screwed by the time the dust has all cleared. And so it's really what we're talking about is the abuse of antitrust exemptions and privacy exemptions that allow them to mess over the public.
And in this case, how did the fans respond?
Well, the fans were not thrilled with how this went down, and then it was made even worse by the fact that the team, as a way to build goodwill, then used the money that they received to be able to bring in a series of very high-priced free agents. And now, that didn't go very well, because you can't just buy a great baseball team no matter what you think when you see the Yankees. And what happened was that the team actually crashed and burned. So what the owners then did was they had a fire sale where they gave up then all the great talent that they'd signed the previous offseason, including several pieces of young talent who'd come up through the farm system. And that made people just feel even worse, because it became like this shell game. And this is who Jeffrey Loria is. He did the same thing with the Montreal Expos. It's this idea of seeing a piece of capital like this, like the sports franchise, to use one of the favorite words of Mitt Romney, as something to harvest and squeeze out every possible cent of it you can, and then just leave the dried husk of it twitching on the ground.
Well, and then who's really watching this? And do these guys have to answer to anyone? Because you also write that the two most egregious examples of how our broken economic system has spread its vampire squid tentacles into the world of sports are found in Major League Baseball, among the two wealthiest media markets in the U.S., New York and Los Angeles. You write that the New York Mets owner Fred Wilpham and his partner Saul Katz bankrupted their franchise by using the team as an ATM to invest with, as well as loan money to, the very imprisoned financier Bernie Madoff. And on the opposite coast, Dodgers owner Frank McCourt became embroiled in the ugliest divorce this side of an MTV reality show. It was revealed that he used his team like a piggy bank. So how can these guys just get away with this?
Well, they get away with it for a couple of reasons. The first and the easiest excuse for how they're able to get away with it is the issue of the antitrust exemption, which gives them this privacy to be able to take public funds and use it for their own private purposes. The second is that I think we have a real fourth estate problem in the world of sports. We have a very real problem with the sports media that is very enmeshed and very in bed with the teams that they're supposed to cover. One of the more disturbing elements in recent years is seeing really good reporters, top reporters, at some of the best sports pages in the country, getting hired directly off the printed page or off the, even the websites, and being hired directly to work for the NBA.com or the NFL.com or MLB.com. And they become the direct employees of the ownerships of the team. I mean, we're talking about, like, not just people on the fringes either, but we're talking about the best of the best work for the actual leagues themselves or the media arms of the leagues. So it gets to this point where nobody's watching, and with the exception of some renegade websites like Deadspin, nobody's really watching the watchers either.
Are you in conversation with any of these sports writers? How do they respond to the information that you reveal?
Oh, I mean, no, I talk to them all the time. And the response I get more often than not is either they're honest and they say, well, they're just, they're real parameters to what we can or cannot talk about. Or they say that I'm being overly one-sided and not looking at the ways in which teams are helpful and beneficial to communities and how it really is a two-way street and the amount that owners sacrifice to make sure that the teams do well. And this to me, and I talk about this in the book, is that this is in line with the whole thing you've heard recently that sometimes some people refer to it as the pity of the billionaire
right. Thing
about, like, oh, these poor job creators who are doing so much to help our communities, they get torn down by people. And in this country, the one thing we can never forgive is success. And I think that's a whole bunch of BS malarkey, to put it mildly. I think that for anybody to defend what owners give back to the community, anytime you hear somebody say that, ask them just straight up, well, have you seen their books? How do you know what they give back? And how do you know what they take? And the answer is that they don't know, because they hide behind the antitrust exemptions and don't make their books public, even though they get public money.
Well, and also, isn't it true that if you have a winning team, sometimes these issues don't really matter? Because you point out that the Pittsburgh Pirates owner Robert Nutting pulled $29.4 million in profits in 2007 and 2008, despite fielding losing teams with a $23 million payroll, the lowest in the game. So it's almost like, well, as long as you win, it's fine if you're doing this. We just want to have a winning team.
And I'll tell you something else too. The reason why I even know those figures and use them in the book, particularly when talking also about the Mets and the Dodgers and the Marlins, is because baseball in 2011 had its own version of the WikiLeaks scandal, where somebody actually had to take the books and anonymously post them online. And that's the only reason we have any transparency at all. It's worth just pointing that out. I think it's very difficult to create a fan base that's willing to hold ownership accountable for financial malfeasance. That's proven to be a very difficult thing to organize. In Pittsburgh, it's also proven difficult despite years and years of a very loyal fan base. Because, I mean, oftentimes people do feel a kind of powerlessness because they feel like, well, sports is just sort of my place where I choose to relax and take a load off and not think about politics. And if the team stinks, then I'll choose to do something else. But they see it much more as, I mean, fans, I think, are really conditioned to see sports as just an entertainment option. And the way they exercise their power is to turn the channel when not looking at some of these bigger issues, like, well, even if you turn the channel, you're still paying your cable bill. Even if you turn the channel, you're still paying higher taxes. Even if you turn the channel, you're still helping subsidize what has become a substitute for anything resembling a real urban policy in this country. This idea that building a stadium will help places like Pittsburgh, for example, that have lost industry, that have become deindustrialized, and that they say that this is an alternative to that. I mean, those are the issues we need to take on, whether the team stinks or not.
We're speaking with sports writer Dave Zirin about his latest book, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And Dave tackles a number of issues in his book. We're talking about basically corporate giveaways to sports teams and how this is allowed. And then also later in the show, we're going to talk about how players are speaking out on various political issues, whether it's gay marriage, what we saw with the unions in Wisconsin. Sportscaster Howard Cosell said sports and politics just don't mix. He actually called it rule number one of the jockocracy. But Dave argues that politics has breached the modern sports arena with a vengeance. And if you have a question for Dave about what he writes about politics and sports, we'd love to hear from you. And if you are a sports fan, do you feel powerless? As he said, a lot of people just feel like, you know, it's not the time for politics. I just want to take part in this game, even though the ticket prices, as far as I know, are going up. And Dave, I still can't believe sometimes how much the, you know, the T-shirts and things cost. When I was a teenager, I went to a lot of these games. And it's just gone up so much over the years. So what are your thoughts on the sports industrial complex and how it's transformed itself into a trillion-dollar global entity? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. As a fan, do you feel like you have any power over these issues? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. And Dave, last time you were on, you were talking about trying to organize fans. How is that going?
I'm on the board of an organization called the Sports Fan Coalition, and we've had successes working around the issue of the blackout in the National Football League, which is this old practice that allows them to not show the games on local television markets if enough seats have not been bought in the stadium. And it's a practice that dates back to back when corporate elites in sports were freaked out about television and thought, well, if people have televisions, then they're not going to come out to the park. And it also harkens back to a time when owners looked their bottom lines, their profits were determined by how many butts they were able to get in the seats. And that's one of the big changes that's taken place. I mean, you talked about the inability to afford to actually attend games. And it's true. I mean, ticket prices have become out of reach for working class families, even middle class families. And there's a method to that about why that's the case. It's such a huge change from like when my father was growing up and he used to trade in a couple of milk bottles for coins and go see Brooklyn Dodgers games. And the Dodgers were happy with that too because they needed to get butts in the seats. But today, so much of how a major league team determines its profitability is about public subsidies. It's about your cable deal, and it's about luxury box seats. But they've really ignored the typical working class, middle class fan. And this is just, once again, the parallels with the financial markets is in Wall Street, to me, just blaze from this, because it's this idea that you're not looking at the long-term viability of your product. You're not concerned about what it's going to look like 50, 60 years from now. You're not concerned about the sense of ownership that ordinary people have of it. You're just looking at your next bottom line.
And Dave, my brother, who's a huge sports fan, just sent me a message on Facebook saying it could cost a family of four over $500 to go to a game. And then he also just sent over a New York Times piece about a sweet TV deal that will taste bitter to fans. It's about the Dodgers teaming up with Time Warner Cable. They just announced this $8 billion 25-year contract. It will carry Dodgers games on the newfangled Sportsnet LA starting in 2014 when the team leaves Prime Ticket. I'm not familiar with Sportsnet LA or Prime Ticket, but what can you tell us about this deal?
And absolutely. I mean, I included some of that in the book, just the early word. When Frank McCourt, who we should be very clear about, it's not the Angela's Ashes Frank McCourt. I feel terrible every time I say that name and the thought that people might think it's the terrific old writer and teacher. But this is a very different Frank McCourt. And this Frank McCourt always knew that he would be able to sell his team because that the cable deal was running out and they'd be able to get a new cable deal and that would be attractive. And it eventually was to Guggenheim Corporation with Magic Johnson as the kind of front man for the deal, the great Los Angeles Laker basketball player turned urban developer. And this cable deal What's so terrible about it is that it is just going to jack up everybody's cable rates for the greater purpose of pumping more money into the Los Angeles Dodgers franchise and into the pockets of Guggenheim Partners and Magic Johnson. And you mentioned not having heard of the cable channels. That's because these cable channels are just made up. I mean, it started really with the New York Yankees, which used to just broadcast on WPIX in New York, Channel 11. That's where you would see the Yankees games. And the Yankees did not make that much more appreciably than, say, the Kansas City Royals. So there was, in the 80s even, you had like this general parity between teams. And, of course, the Royals and the Yankees met in the playoffs as well in the 1980s. Yet then the Yankees started something called YES. What a lovely name that is, YES. It stands for, I believe, Yankee Entertainment and Sports or something like that. And by creating this independent entity, YES, it's like a form of vertical integration. And you have then people are paying more to their cable companies for YES, which is owned by the Yankees. And then the Yankees get that money directly, and then people can watch the games at home. In Los Angeles, the Dodgers are following, and they've been waiting patiently for years, actually, to follow the YES model of cable broadcasting.
We're speaking with Dave Zirin about the intersection of sports and politics. He's out with a new book called Game Over. And let's go to a few callers before we take a break. Let's hear from Patty in San Mateo. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I am asking about, when it comes to transparency, what's going on in Sacramento? You know, the Sacramento people have voted down the arena, and now our mayor is going to the playoffs so that he can represent Sacramento. And you know, we're starting to wonder, who's this guy working for? I mean, and does he really not like the Maloofs, or is he an agent of the Maloofs?
Patty, can you give us a little background about what's happening in Sacramento?
Well,
You
go ahead.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, this guy's probably got more dirt than I do.
All right. Thank you, Patty. So Dave, what's happening in Sacramento?
Well, first of all, Patty, thanks so much for calling. And I agree with a lot of your characterizations, which we'll explain here. The mayor of Sacramento is former NBA All-Star Kevin Johnson. The Sacramento Kings have a group of owners named the Maloofs, who they made their money the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. And they have proceeded to run the team into the ground financially. And this was after the Sacramento Kings were the most successful franchises, was one of the best fan bases in the NBA. You might remember roughly 10 years ago when they were ran deep into the playoffs with players like Chris Webber and Vlade Divac. And they want to sell the Kings, or they said they needed a new arena. Now, there was not public support or money in California for either of those things, so the Maloofs were looking to sell, and particularly looking to sell to, this is horrible irony, but looking to sell to a business group out of Seattle who would then take the Kings and move them to Seattle, where their franchise was taken from them by a gentleman named Clay Bennett and moved to Oklahoma City. So you're talking about like that the Sacramento fan base is about to get deeply abused to be able to satisfy the hurt wounds of a fan base in Seattle that was deeply abused when the team moved out of there as well. And it all comes down to this issue, once again, of public subsidies and who is going to offer the best kind of sweetheart deal. And I hear what you're saying so much about who does Kevin Johnson work for? Does he work for the Maloofs? Does he work for the league? Or does he work for us? Because you don't see a fight. You see a fighter in Kevin Johnson, but he's fighting more to keep the team than to get the best possible deal for the city. Mm-hmm.
Hold that thought, Dave. We're going to take a quick break, and I'd love for you to elaborate on that and then also talk about what happened in San Francisco with the 49ers. We're speaking with Dave Zirin, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear our new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
Mm-hmm.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Ken and Melanie Light. They spent 5 years documenting the Central Valley through photographs and essays for their book, Valleys of Shadows and Dreams. They met such a wide range of people struggling with foreclosures, environmental pollution, water scarcity, and an ever-widening wage gap. So what can we do to move towards social, economic, and environmental justice for the people working in the nation's bread basket? You'll definitely want to tune in. The book is full of amazing photographs. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with sports writer Dave Zirin. He's a columnist for The Nation and Slam Magazine. He's the host of SiriusXM's popular weekly show, Edge of Sports Radio. His last book was A People's History of Sports in the United States. His latest book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And in his new book, Dave writes about everything from these sweet deals that are given to these teams to various athletes that are breaking Howard Cosell's rule about not mixing sports with politics. And we'll talk about that a little later in the show. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on sports and the economy? If there's anything that's changed in your area with your team, if you were ever able to vote on whether or not a stadium should be subsidized, what are your thoughts on that? And what are your thoughts on how these deals are pushed through? And in many cases, as Dave said, there's really no transparency. In fact, he got a lot of information about the baseball teams because someone leaked it. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. So, Dave, I wanted to finish your thought before the break. Patty called in about the Kings in Sacramento moving to Seattle.
Yeah, I just have a little factoid to end with there. And this probably doesn't mean much of anything, but I thought I'd point out that Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento, is in a long-term relationship with someone your listeners might have heard of by the name of Michelle Rhee.
Oh, and, really?
The former D.C. superintendent of schools, who has since become a high-moneyed backer of the idea of basically just destroying public education in this country. I'm sorry, I'm not a big Michelle Rhee fan here, seeing as I'm married to someone who's a D.C. teacher. There are just some really interesting parallels here, because what do you always hear about education in this country? They always say you can't throw money at the problem. Teachers say we need better books, we need smaller class sizes. Well, you can't just throw money at the problem. Yet when it comes to sports, it seems like there is always money to throw at the problem.
Well, and what are your thoughts just quickly on what happened with the 49ers? Even when they were going to the Super Bowl, the media didn't talk about the fact that they were leaving San Francisco.
Yeah. Such a quiet story there, to put it mildly. I think it really does constitute a sad ending of an era and a sad betrayal as well. I mean, I think that there's a really nice history in Giants land, in particular, of the owner of the team there, Peter McGowan, who wanted to have a publicly subsidized stadium, the fans drawing a line and saying it's not going to happen, and so him forcing him to privately subsidize his own ballpark. And there's no reason, given that the National Football League is such an economic behemoth, that the 49ers couldn't have done the same, that the York family couldn't have done the same. I thought it's really, really quite shameful of both them and their prepubescent patriarch, Jed York, doing something like this.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Patty. And we've got full lines, so let's go next to Jim in Berkeley. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show. Hello, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hi. Go ahead.
I live in Alameda County, where we're buying a stadium for the Oakland Raiders, the modifications. And what I'm wondering is why people in the cities haven't forced their elected officials to seize these teams and then run them as a nonprofit, sort of the way the Green Bay Packers do, and then pour all the profits back into social service agencies. It seems like a win-win for the fans and the local residents, rather than subsidizing these private stadiums where we get no gain.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And Dave, talk a little bit about this, because you write about Green Bay, owned by 112,000 fans. This is a community-run nonprofit. First off, this is the only community-run nonprofit team in the country. Is that right?
In the major sports leagues, yes, there are some minor league teams that are run this way.
And how did this happen?
In the four major sports, that's it. Well, I mean, first of all, let me just say to the caller, what you just argued, I've been arguing that for years, writing about it, speaking about it for years. I think public subsidizing should come with public ownership. And the fact that public subsidizing does not come with public ownership is just one of the greatest scams that, our system has perpetuated, both in sports and beyond. Now, that being said, the issue with the Green Bay Packers is that they became a publicly or a fan-owned franchise as a way to stave off financial ruin back in the 1920s. And this was a time where people would win NFL franchises in card games or at horse races. I mean, it was not a major sport in this country at this time. And when the sports was obvious that it was going to get huge, the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, wrote it into the bylaws of the National Football League that no team could be run as a nonprofit and no team could be community owned. And this was adopted by other teams, other leagues as well. So, for example, when Joan Kroc, whose husband Ray Kroc was the real, was the power behind McDonald's, the CEO of McDonald's, they also owned the San Diego Padres, the baseball team. When Joan Kroc passed away, she tried to leave the team. It was in her will and testament to the city of San Diego to be run exactly like the caller said, to be something that where the profits would go directly into city social services. And the Major League Baseball sued and prevented that from actually taking place. So they are very serious about that. It's going to have to be challenged in a highly legislative fashion for those bylaws to ever change. Because, I mean, frankly, owners are superfluous now in sports. We're paying for the stadiums. Fans go to watch the players. And there's no real role that owners play at this point except, a parasitic role.
And you write about Green Bay, and this is really important because it's a community-run nonprofit. Is it Lambeau Field will never be torn down and replaced with a $1.5 billion monument to corporate welfare. They give 60% of their concession profits to local charities. I mean, that is incredible. And then when they need a cash infusion, they sell more stock instead of passing on the tax burden. And perhaps most importantly, in Wisconsin, beer prices at the stadium are at roughly half of that at the average stadium. But as you write, rather than celebrate these facts when they won the Super Bowl in 2011, Fox buried them. Does this get much attention in the sports world that Green Bay is a nonprofit community-run team?
No, not even during the Super Bowl, where usually there's a great deal of time at the big game with the camera going up to the owner's box and looking at the owners fretting as if they're, you know, their Caesar up there looking down upon the field. And in the recent Super Bowl a couple years back that had the Packers against the Steelers, I thought it actually became, partly because I was looking for it, of course, but I thought it became really awkward because the Steelers are owned by one of the great and storied patriarchal families in the history of sports, the Rooney family out in Pittsburgh. And there was no effort to even show the Rooneys during the game. And the reason why they didn't show the Rooneys is because for the Packers, there was nobody really to show. And that would be extremely awkward. I mean, this is not something that's celebrated. It's something that's ignored.
You also point out that during the massive protests in Wisconsin, you were there covering it, and you said you saw so many people wearing Packers hats and Packers shirts. And you said when you're from New York City, and it's difficult to imagine a labor demonstration with masses of workers and students wearing Jets and Giants gear.
Yeah, and it's funny. Actually, I was in Madison by coincidence that week. I wasn't there to cover the protests, but then ended up staying for several days afterwards because what I was witnessing was just so remarkable. And it is true, like seeing people not just wearing Packers gear, but people made all these signs that said Aaron Rodgers, referencing the Green Bay quarterback, is a union rep. And this was, of course, this happened simultaneously with NFL players getting locked out during that offseason. And so you had a lot of statements from the union, a lot of statements from other players, and a lot of statements from people on the Green Bay Packers, including by their defensive captain, Charles Woodson, sounding out in support of the public sector workers in Wisconsin. And in their statements, reference was made to the fact that, like, look, we're the people's team. We're owned by the people, and therefore we have a responsibility to the people. in this particular struggle. And that even their coach, when they won the Super Bowl, he said in his speeches, he said, the fingerprints of everybody in the state of Wisconsin are on this trophy because we are the people's team.
We have an email from Art, who also wanted to talk about the Green Bay Packers. He says, can you compare the way such a franchise operates with a privately owned sports franchise? And I'm wondering, when you're talking about something like the Green Bay Packers, a community nonprofit team, how are the workers treated? Because I just found this piece over at SFIST about AT&T Park, and it says that at the Giants Fan Fest, I think this is a website, Local 2, the hospitality union, points out that despite having won two World Series and the team's operating income has gone up $63 million, concession workers at AT&T Park have seen $0 in wage increases over the last 4 years.
Right. No, and that's part of the problem, too, is that, and this goes for Green Bay, this goes for all teams, is that the work is treated like seasonal. And this is another reason why public investments in stadium infrastructure is such a bad investment, is that the kind of jobs it creates are the jobs where legally it's easiest to exploit workers, because you're not bound to any of the laws that accompany if you have someone working full-time 365 days a year. I mean, especially think about an NFL team where a place like Lambeau Field is going to be open 8, 9, 10 days out of 365. That's a very difficult kind of thing to then organize around when the labor itself is that flexible and that disposable. But to get to your point, though, that it's also very important, is, and this I talked about this in the book in the last couple of years, is that that's also what made so the lockouts in recent years. There have been 4 lockouts in the last year. That's what made them so political and so more explosive than a typical sports labor issue, is that they were also locking out the owners of these teams. They were also locking out the stadium workers. They were, in effect, locking out people who worked as waiters, waitresses, and bartenders at the places next to the stadium and around the stadium. They were locking out entire neighborhoods that were promised developments during when the construction was going on and so many places were going out of business and neighborhoods were being transformed or gentrified. So there's a public trust that exists there without similar public oversight or public reinvestment.
And according to this piece about the workers at the Giants Stadium, well, now AT&T Park, I still can't call it that, the 750 workers are employed by South Carolina-based Centerplate. But Local 2 says they've been told at the bargaining table that it's the Giants who control the pricing at the park and take a significant share of the park's revenue. So it seems like they're just starting this campaign, and we'll see where it goes. We're speaking today with Dave Zirin about his new book, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. We've got just over about 10 minutes left, so if you'd like to weigh in on the conversation, what are your thoughts on how these deals are made? If you have a big team in your area, what are your thoughts about how the stadium is run, how it's funded? If you've ever had to vote on these issues, how did you vote? And then also, I will spend some time talking about players speaking out politically. What are your thoughts on that angle here? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I guess maybe professional sport seems to be quintessential capitalism, if you will, as far as I'm concerned. I live in the Bay Area and used to be a follower of the 49ers years ago. But, you know, I wanted to make a different reference here. And just it seems that across the board, because I live close to Stanford, across the board, there just seems to be a level, and I don't know if corruption is the right word, but I'll just give you an example, and I know you're aware of this. I mean, with the scandals that have occurred with Sandusky, et cetera. You know, if you peel back, and I used to be a collegiate coach, if you peel this stuff back, you find out that starting at the lowest levels of, you know, peewee football, going into high school, then to collegiate football, you've got situations where you've got coaches making, you know, 10 times what a college professor makes. You've got graduation rates at colleges, even at Cal, at less than 50%. And so my guess is, and I know you, I'm sure you've written about this, it across the board, if you just sort of peel this back, peel the curtain back, people are going to find out things that they weren't even aware of that are going on at virtually every level of sport. So I had personal experiences where I knew people were using money improperly at the collegiate level where I was coaching. Mm. So it's just this doesn't surprise me, and it just seems to escalate once you start at that lower level and get up to the higher levels. But you can look at your collegiate sports, and that's where I think this really begins big time.
Well, thank you for the call, Dave. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I have a whole chapter in the book about not just Sandusky. I have one about Sandusky and Penn State, and also one entire separate one about the NCAA. And absolutely, I mean, just one stat that I always use to illustrate for people how much money has come to dominate college sports is at Ohio State, their old legendary, somewhat infamous football coach, Woody Hayes, at his peak, and this is in the early 1980s, made $40,000 a year. Not bad for the early 80s. Nothing to certainly get you on the cover of Forbes magazine either. Their coach today, Urban Meyer, makes as a base salary $4 million a year. Mm. So that's a 30-year difference, and we've gone from 40 grand to 4 million. And yet the one thing about the sport that hasn't changed is that the athletes still don't get paid. They have no rights as workers. They have no rights as the campus employees that they are. And, of course, this is going to breed corruption on every level. I mean, it breeds corruption because the sports team, usually the football team, becomes this economic and social and psychological life raft for an entire collegiate community, while at the same time making coaches the most powerful people on campus, like as you said and as you referenced. And I think the reason why the Penn State scandal really touched a nerve, there are, of course, so many reasons why it did, but it was kind of a look in, down the looking glass, so to speak, about how much a college would actually put up with if it meant protecting the golden goose of their football program. We know that colleges will put up with payola under the table. We know they've put up with all kinds of scandals before, whether it's drugs, or we know sexual assault between people over the age of 18, as of course between men and women, has been covered up tremendously in the world of collegiate sports. And now here's a case of serial child raping. Mm-hmm. And this gets covered up as well, because heaven forbid anything get in the way of having the trains run on time for the football team.
You also write about the University of Oregon, which the state legislature hiked in-state tuition 9%, passed an 11% decrease in funding to the Oregon system for 2011 and 2012, and yet the school is not in a state of complete disrepair thanks to Nike's emperor in charge, Phil Knight, who backed a $41 million athletic center in the ground floor bathrooms, which are inlaid with black marble. A portrait of Phil Knight's wife, Penny, graces the wall. And it's just wild how you describe this athletic team. And as you say, that if an athlete in Oregon gets hurt, there's no compensation. If he doesn't fit into a playing scheme, even if he has a 4.0, his scholarship is revoked. If his jersey is sold, he doesn't see a cent of the profits.
Yeah.
And is this pretty common?
Oregon is in some ways a very specific case because it's underwritten by Nike to such a degree. But to me, that only points out the contradictions all the deeper. Mm. I mean, you've got members of staff who've been working there for decades who are getting put on mandatory furloughs, and yet you go into the Nike Athletic Center and you see all these young receptionists who look like they flew in straight from Milan to be able to take calls and greet you when you walk in the door. I mean, it shows both the privilege that's given to big time athletes, while at the same time pointing out, my goodness, so you have money for this athletic center, but these athletes don't make a cent. It's like they're this uneasy combination of being campus gods and campus chattel, and they have to live with that duality day in and day out at ages when most of us are just trying to figure out whether or not we're going to go to the hot bar or the deli in the school cafeteria.
Well, we've got an email from Christian. This is interesting. He says, if sports and politics are supposed to be separate, as Howard Cosell said, why do we sing the national anthem, God Bless America, fly fighter jets before games, and promote support for military and war?
Yeah, I mean, the question answers itself. And to me, this points out the stubborn secret truth about sports, which is that it's not sports and politics that aren't allowed to mix. It's sports and a certain kind of politics that aren't allowed to mix. Sports and resistance politics, sports and iconoclastic politics, sports and politics that push against the dominant ideas of the status quo. But if you want sports and politics that cheerlead for militarism, sports and politics that cheerlead for nationalism, those kinds of politics are extremely acceptable. I mean, don't speak out for women's rights, but by all means have cheerleaders. I mean, that's the political ethos that guides sports.
And what about players who are actually speaking out on these issues? You write about a number of cases, and I just, again, thanks to my brother, he's sending me all these great stories about sports players speaking out. You've got Chris Clue, a punter for the Minnesota Vikings. He's a punter, so he's not a popular player, but he's a big supporter of gay marriage. Most fans have never heard of him because he's not on SportsCenter. And then there's also an interesting article over at NBC about five of the best and most famous NFL players of the last two decades joining together in a public service announcement for gun violence prevention. People like Deion Sanders, Marshall Faulk, Emmitt Smith, they're appearing in an ad from Mayors Against Illegal Guns. So are you seeing an increase in players speaking out on these issues, and why?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I think since 2008 you've seen a massive increase. I think there are several reasons for this. The first and most obvious is that since 2008, we've been living in a state of kind of perpetual crisis from the economic collapse in 2008, hangover, of course, from Hurricane Katrina and the failed wars overseas. And as one athlete said in the book, and I quote him in the book, is that it's not like athletes have their own CNN. You know, they're part of this world, too. And so the things that are happening in the world affect them as well. But the other reason, which cannot be it can't be overlooked, I don't think enough can be said about it, is just the advent of social media, which has allowed athletes to also get around decades of built-in mistrust against members of the established sports media who tend to be very old, very white, very conservative, and very hostile to athletes. And so the ability, the freedom to be able to get your message across to fans and to the public is something that a lot of athletes have chosen to take advantage of.
And are athletes talking about the system itself, about the corporate giveaways, for example, what's happening at the college level, about, I know they definitely spoke out on the lockouts, but are they also talking about these other issues?
The college level, definitely. That, to me, is the issue for athletes, that it does not take a lot of incentive, for particularly once they're done with college, to speak out on what a horrible racket the whole thing is. I mean, we're talking I do get to talk to a lot of athletes, and that's a 9 out of 10 right there, where they will just go off on the experience of being in college and being told they're a student athlete, which is just such a sham. As for talking about, like, corporate public subsidies and things like that, that's a much more difficult nut to crack. For reasons that really should be obvious, I guess, you know, because it's part of the pool that goes into helping create their own salaries and salary structures, and they do have such a short time in the limelight. But it was very good to see the unions in the lockout. I thought this was a big step in terms of them speaking out for the workers who are also being locked out, the minimum wage workers, the $8 an hour workers at the stadium, the people who parked the cars. I mean, that really was historic by the NFL Players Association in making those kinds of connections. And I think that's what we want. I mean, that's what I think what people want, is that it's less about the public subsidies for the teams and more that public subsidies does not come with either public oversight, public ownership, or public responsibility. It's just this one-way street right into the owner's pockets. So I think the more that that's recognized by athletes, the more it'll have a hearing in the mainstream media.
And here's a good last question for you, Dave, from our listener, Carl. He says, I don't have a TV and can't afford to go to games, but given how the San Francisco teams are doing, it's hard to completely break the habit. What is Dave's argument for not just breaking the pro sports habit, working on social justice in a wider arena and letting sports take care of itself?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first is that to deny sports as part of our daily existence is also a way sort of like denying reality. I mean, it's part of the world that we live in. And also, I think that there are tons of, for people concerned about social justice issues, there are so many terrific discussions to have within the framework of social justice that are taking place in the world of sports. Right now, as we speak, I mean, I just did an article about this NBA player named Royce White, who said he is willing to die to make sure that there's universal mental health coverage in the United States. Mm. I mean, that is not an issue that gets discussed at all,
right,
mental health in this country. And yet the fact that an athlete is talking about it, then it becomes something that we can actually discuss and maybe make connections with people who only read the sports page and don't read anything else. So I think it's an incredibly powerful bridge that people who care about social justice should learn more about. And that, whether that's reading my book, hey, that's awesome. But not just by reading the book.
And
learn more about this, and you'll be surprised at the amount of connections that you're going to be able to make with the people around you.
And just quickly, Dave, this has been a very male-dominated show. We didn't even get to talk about female athletes. But are they speaking out?
Well, there's a lot of women athletes speaking out on LGBT issues in recent years. But for female athletes, we're going to have to do a whole hour on that. Because the amount of sexism in sports and the amount of what's sometimes referred to as the kind of like claiming your own body and objectifying yourself and being in things like the women's Playboy, Women of the Olympics issue and things like that. I mean, these things are becoming more and more prevalent in sports, and it's something that needs to be consciously worked on right now. And I have a whole chapter in the book about women in sports.
Yeah, that made me cringe, especially Danica Patrick modeling in the red leather underwear.
Yeah.
So, yes, we would love to do another show about that because that hardly gets a mention. Dave Zirin is author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, thanks so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back again.
Oh, my privilege. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Thanks for listening. It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What does life in the Central Valley reveal about the problems in our industrial food system? On the next Jour Call, we'll speak with Ken and Melanie Light. They spent 5 years documenting the Central Valley through photographs and essays for their book, Valley of Shadows and Dreams. They met people struggling with foreclosures, environmental pollution, water scarcity, immigration, and an ever-widening wage gap. How can we move towards social, economic, and environmental justice for our nation's breadbasket? It's Jour Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Jour Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Jour Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.